And a little bit of review. As I said in the email that I sent out, you know, given that the last time we did this was either the last week in June or the first week in July, I don't remember exactly, but the bottom line is it's been a while, and therefore it's worth it to take a couple of minutes to get us back into where we are in this book of Shoftim of Judges. The section we're on is chapters 4 and 5. We already did, and I'm not going to go back over the first three chapters. We can start with 4 and 5, but the Jews are living in the land that was Canaan, is now Eretz Yisrael. We have scattered to different parts. Each tribe, each Shevet, has gotten its own area. And the leaders of the Jewish people are called Shoftim, which we defined potentially as judges. And some of them, like Devorah, who we're going to read about here, actually, we're told, did judge. Others seem to have spent their time as military leaders, and we don't know anything about their judicial career. But Shoftim are named by God. And there's some element of prophecy in choosing the Shofet. In some of them, it says explicitly that the Spirit of God was on them, and that's how they knew that they were to take on this role. Most of the stories in this book begin with there was an enemy, and the enemy was in control of the Jews, and then the Jews called out to God. God appointed for them a Shofet, and then the Shofet led them, and hopefully things got a little bit better. We talked about, before the summer, the question of whether the Jews actually repent, then they get the Shofet, or whether the Shofet leads the Jews to repent, how exactly that cycle works, and it's really unclear from within the book. So this part of the Sefer, this part of the book, chapters 4 and 5, start with the Jews being under the control of Canaan. Now, Canaan, of course, is the name of the land itself, but it also can refer to a sub-tribe that's living there. Not all the Canaanites, but a particular group, which particular clan that was there, were known as the Canaanites. And of course, they are longtime enemies of the Jewish people. Canaanim have a long history of attacking us in the Midbar, in the wilderness, when the Jews were on their way from Egypt into Israel, as well as before then. But the Jews are under the control of Canaan. And then we find Devorah. And Devorah is the leader of the Jews. I'm going to want to spend more time on her as we go through the rest of the chapter. But what we know about her is she is described as a Nevi'ah. She is a prophet. She also is a Shofet. She is a judge. She has no family in the story, except that she is described as Eshet Lapidot, which could mean that she is the wife of a man named Lapidot. Lapidot is an odd name for a human being. It's not one of those names that you see show up in Tanakh. It means torches. So it's a little bit odd to think that that will be him. Plus, we never see anybody identified by that name in this story. And the way she's mentioned as the wife of Lapidot, I would have expected that if Lapidot was a person, then we would have some idea who he is. He would have some history or something. You don't say the wife of so-and-so unless you know who so-and-so is. And we don't. We don't have anything. So that leads to other possibilities we discussed as to what Lapidot might mean. Maybe she made wicks for the menorah in the Beis Hamikdash, or maybe she's being described as a fiery person, which would certainly fit with what we see of her in chapters 4 and 5. We discussed a little bit about her role as a judge, because we are told that from the perspective of Jewish law, judges are male. So we gave a few different explanations. One explanation was that may be, but God said she is now going to be the Shofet. So, you know, that's the rule. Another explanation is that Shofet doesn't have to mean judge per se. It can mean teacher of laws. And then a third possibility, which fits with the way we handle judgeships in Judaism, is that she could just have been accepted by the people. They treat her this way. They accept her because they recognize her wisdom, they recognize her righteousness, and they say, okay, so formally, there may be no position of judge like this, but we're going to her with our cases anyway. And that's brought by halachic authorities as a potential basis for it. So the Jews are led by Devorah. They're living under Canaan. And we explained, and this is important in order to understand the story as it plays out, the Canaanim are in control of low-lying areas, whereas the Jews are forced up into the mountains in the middle of the country, right? Smack in the middle of the country. And that's going to shape part of what develops here, as we'll see. So in the beginning of chapter 4, the Jews have sinned. Hashem gives us into the hands of, or literally sells us, as we talked about, into the hands of Yavin, who is the head of Canaan. He has a general whose name is Sisera. Right? We talked about Yavin. Is this an inherited name of their leaders? Because we knew about a Yavin who was defeated back in Yehoshua. That's old news. So for 20 years, we are in the hands of Canaan. And then we find out about Devorah, this Eshet Lapidot. She judges people sitting beneath a palm tree that becomes known as the palm tree of Devorah. Everybody knows this is where you go. This is where you find Devorah judging people. We talked about why she's outside and not inside a building. Potentially it's done in order to make sure there's no suspicion that anything is going on. She's out there in the open. And she, if you take a look, you might as well start looking at it inside in the psukim, in the verses themselves. Pasuk Vav, sentence 6, chapter 4. Still going through it quickly. I'm not going to read everything out yet because this is still the review. She calls for Barak ben Avinoam from Naphtali. And she says to him, you know, God has commanded, or literally, hasn't God commanded? The question of how you take the word hallo is one that we talked about. But she says, God has commanded you to gather 10,000 men on Har Tavor from the tribes of Naphtali and Zvulun, and you shall go to Nachal Kishon to Sisera and all his chariots and all of his forces, and I'm going to give them into your hand. Right? Does that sound familiar for those who were here before the summer? Right? We're good? Okay. So she tells Barak, this is the plan by which you are going to do battle. Gather the troops on Har Tavor, and ultimately you are going to go to war against Canaan. Barak says, not so fast. He says in sentence 8, Pasuk Chet, Im telchi imi v'halachti. If you go with me, great. Otherwise, no way. He says, "V'im lo selchi mi, if you're not going with me, lo elech, I'm not going." Right? Barak is afraid to go to war without Devorah. Why is Barak afraid to go to war without Devorah?
Well, it says here that he was afraid that God will not be with him if she's not coming.
Right. So one possible explanation is that he wants her merit. He wants to have her merit as somebody who clearly is close to God, and so he says, "I without you on my side, I'm not willing to go." Another possible, yeah.
He says, "I shall deliver him." She says, "I shall deliver him," instead of "God shall deliver."
She's quoting God. If you look at the beginning of the sentence, okay. She says, "God has commanded," and everything else is a
and
quote.
I shall deliver. Okay, yeah. So that's God's word. Okay.
Yeah. So the other way to look at it is that she's there to inspire the people. Who's Barak? You know, but she's the shofate. She is the one who people view as a leader, and they'll follow her. So Barak says, if you'll go, fine. If you're not going, then forget it. There's no point. And we talked about why she picks Barak, Barak being a career soldier possibly. Barak may have been her husband. That's also part of the conversation. But she says back to Barak, fine. Haloch eleich imach, pasuk tet, sentence 9. She says, I'll go with you. Efes ki lo siya tif'artucha al haderach asherata holeich. But you should know, you will not get glory by doing this in this way. Kiviyadi shayim kor Hashem es Sisera. God is going to sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. We know, of course, that's going to be Yael in this story. And she says, fine, now I'll go with Barak to Kedesh Naphtali. And Mitzudat David explained, we saw it already earlier, that what she's saying is, success in war comes from one of two things. I mean, not success in war, sorry, glory in war comes from one of two things. Either if you win, or if you're exceptionally brave, right? We glorify, right or wrong, human nature. We glorify either the victor of the war or the one who was really valiant in defeat. Those are the ones who people will honor. So she says, your success is going to come via Yael, right? Yeah, Sisera is going to fall, but he's going to fall to Yael, so you're not getting credit for that. And as far as bravery, since you need me to go along and be the standard bearer, you don't have bravery either. So you should just know that you've lost whatever you were going to gain by doing this. Okay, so they go. Pasuk Yud, sentence 10, Barak rallies Zvulun and Naphtali to Kedesh, Kedesh being the Kedesh that's in Naphtali, and he gets the 10,000, and Devorah goes with him. And then we had this odd sentence, Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11. And those who were here hopefully will remember that we had to spend some time explaining what this was doing here. There's a man by the name of Chever. We have not met him yet in this story. We have not met him yet in Tanakh. Well, that's not true. We might have met him in Tanakh. We have not met him in this book of Shoftim. But there is a man by the name of Chever who is of the tribe of Cani. And this fellow separated from Cain, meaning he separated from the Cani family, who were, by the way, the descendants of Chovav, who is Moshe's father-in-law. So Chever, this is a little tricky. Chever is a Cani. The Cani are descendants of Moshe's father-in-law, who is named Chovav here. How else do we know Moshe's father-in-law?
Yitro.
Yitro, good. So Chever is with the Cani, who are those descendants of Moshe's father-in-law. He separates from them, and he moves his tent to Elon Bitza'ananim, which is with Kedesh. Kedesh being the place where Barak is rallying his troops. So all the troops are massing on the mountain here. Chever had actually been here. I mean, I'm pretending here means anything, but west is here, east is there. I need to go back to the blueberries, right? West is here, east is here in Israel, okay? And Chever had been living here, and he moves to be near the battle. And then we're going to go back to Sisera and the war. So what was this sentence doing here? You know, what's going on? So a couple of things. First of all, the Cani in general are our allies. The Cani generally get along well with the Jewish people. As descendants of Yitro, that makes sense. We discussed the question of whether they converted to Judaism or not. A lot of our sources seem to indicate that they did not convert to Judaism. We did note that Malbim, Rabbi Yehuda Leibush Malbim, believes that they did convert to Judaism, but the majority of sources seem to indicate that they're not Jewish. They're just friendly to Jews, ever since that relationship between Moshe and his father-in-law Yitro. So, according to Don Isaac Abarbanel, did I bring it on the sheet? No, I didn't. I didn't go back that far on the sheet. According to Don Isaac Abarbanel, Chever's move is stuck here because he actually does it as a plot to help the Jews when he sees the war developing. He says, look, the Cani are known as friends of the Jews. If the Canaanite think that I am an ally of the Jews, then I won't be able to help the Jews at all because they're going to view me as an enemy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pretend to have a falling out with my family, these Philo-Jewish Cani, and I'm going to move away. Happened to be right near Kedesh, which is where this war is building. And so now I will be in position to help. So according to that, right, remember I gave the man in motion example from football, but I'm in the wrong class to do that. But this is as the play is beginning, right? And all the sides are lining up. So he's running behind the line of scrimmage, and he's going to get set up over here, ready to move as needed. The irony, of course, being that he doesn't end up doing anything. It's actually Yael, his wife, who's going to be the one who's going to do it. But that's par for the course. So, right.
That's got to be a real friend of the Jews to have to stand up before, yeah, they're needed and just take action.
Yes, this makes him a good guy. The another view of what happened.
And so Yael is his husband, is his wife?
Correct. Oh. Correct. Others, like Ralbag, for example, disagree with that understanding of what happened. They agree with the historical event that he moved. It's there explicitly in the verse. But they suggest that it's actually something that had happened ages ago, and not as a plan at all, and it's only mentioned here because it is going to matter in the story. In other words, we're saying that Barak has rallied the troops and he's got them onto the mountain. By the way, at some point, a while back, Chever, who was a Keni, had moved away from the rest of his brethren and settled in Kadesh. And the only reason it's here is to tell me that because of the role Yael is going to play, you want to know why there's a Keni living in Kadesh? That's not where the Keni live. The Keni are there because Chever moved away ages ago.
It's like a bracket.
It's like setting,
yeah.
Setting the stage.
Yeah. So those are the two different schools of thought as to what in the world this line is doing here. Because you look at it and think, the sentence before we learned about the Jews rallying their troops to Kadesh. The next sentence, Sisera is going to hear about it and start a war. Like, why do I need to know about Chever moving? So either this is when he moved, or this is important because of what's coming next. Either way. So now, Pasuk Yudbet, sentence 12. They tell Sisera that Barak ben Avinoam has in fact ascended to Mount Tavor, and Sisera says, okay, I'm going to rally 900 iron chariots. That's his key weapon. That's the power of the Knaanim. That's why the Jews were able to survive up in the mountains while he reigns in the low-lying areas, because you can't take an iron chariot up a mountain. Doesn't work. So the Jews are safe as long as they're on the mountains. And they just, you know, can't come down. That's all. So the Sisera rallies his 900 iron chariots and all of his forces from Charoshet HaGoyim, which was his capital, to go to Nachal Kishon, which is off in the west, and that's where this battle is going to take place. Vatomer Dvaral Barak, Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. Dvorah says to Barak, Kum, get up. Which suggests he's still in need of a little push. Because this is the day when God has given Sisera into your hands. God has gone before you, meaning God is actually the one taking the lead. He has arranged everything. Vayered Barak Mehar Tavor. Barak descended from Mount Tabor. Vaaseres Alafim Ish Acharav with his 10,000 troops. I love the Dat Mikra edition of Tanakh. They give you pictures. So here I have a picture of Har Tavor with some sheep grazing. I don't know what that adds exactly to my understanding of what's going on. But Har Tavor, yeah. Someone help the sheep. That's basically what it tells me. Look, there is a mountain called Har Tavor. Okay, fine. So,
some people are very visual learners.
Yes, you are right. Sheep presumably are. So the so that's the move has been made. Pasuk Tedvav, sentence 15, still in chapter 4. Vayom Hashem es Sisera ves kol harecha ves kol hamachaneh lefi cherev lefnei Barak. God is vayom. Vayom is a statement of confusion. God creates confusion among Sisera and his chariots and his camp, and they are driven by the sword before Barak, and Sisera gets off his chariot and flees. He runs away. So what is this Vayaham that's going on? So here I refer you to Perek Hay, to chapter 5. And I mentioned this back when we started this unit, that really you have to read chapter 4 with chapter 5, because chapter 5 is the song of Devorah, in which she recaps events from this war, but she mentions things that aren't in the initial account. So in chapter 5, we're going to get more information than we see in number 4. So chapter 5, sentence 19. Specifically, actually, look at sentence 20. I don't need 19. Min shamayim nilchamu. They fought against our enemy from the heavens. Hakochavim mimesilosam nilchamu im Sisera. The stars from their paths in the sky fought with Sisera. Nachal Kishon Grafam. Remember what a nachal is? What's a nachal? We've talked about this. Owadi, right. It's an area that sometimes suddenly will fill with water and sometimes will be dry. So Nachal Kishon is such a place, and it fills with water and it sweeps them away, which explains why you have to get off your chariot. Your chariot is now stuck in the mud. Nachal Kidumim, Nachal Kishon, etc. We're going to come back to that when we see it in chapter 5, but I wanted you to understand what's going on when it says that there is great confusion. And I brought you, I didn't bring it on the sheets this time, but I brought it when we did this initially, that Josephus actually records this in his account of the war in Antiquities of the Jews, volume 5, available on Amazon, or free online. But what he records is that there's a great rain and the chariots become mired in the mud. The idea of the stars fighting is also part of this. We'll have to come back to that in chapter 5.
Didn't you mention also the Mitzrayim? Wasn't that the same word?
Yes. Right, good. The other piece of it that we know contributes to this idea is that if you look back in Shmos, in the story in Exodus chapter 14 of what happens with the Egyptian camp at the sea, the Torah there says, Vayahom es machane Mitzrayim, same term, Vayahom, he caused confusion, but there it tells you what it is. It's that God causes them to be stuck in the mud in their chariots, and Vayasar es ofan markavosav, the axles of the chariots fall off so that they can't move. So that's another association. It's an association between the two stories, and it's also what helps us understand what is referred to when it says there was confusion here. The chariots are routed, and Sisera flees. But what's particularly interesting here about Sisera fleeing is the way that it's depicted, and Radak picked this up. It says here, Sisera gets off of his chariot, right, and he flees on foot. Then in the next sentence it says, Barak ran after the chariots and after the camp all the way to Charoshet HaGoyim, which was the capital of the Canaanim. That was mentioned the part before this, in the beginning of chapter 4. And all of Sisera's camp falls by the sword. Nobody remains. And Sisera fled on foot to the tent of Yael in sentence 17. What does that tell you about Sisera?
He left his people.
He left his troops. He didn't just get off the chariot.
That's like rule number one. You don't do that if you're a sergeant.
Yes. He's the general.
General, whatever. Right. Yeah.
That's correct.
You leave them.
He isn't just getting off of his chariot because the chariot can't move. He's getting off the chariot in order to run
to
the other way.
His skin.
Yes. That's the character. That's what Radak points out, which contributes to the overall theme here in these two chapters. Right, in which you have, on the one hand, Yael and Devorah as these fearless people, and then on the other hand, you have Barak, who doesn't want to go without Devorah, and now you have Sisera, the mighty Canaanite general, who runs the other way, trying to save himself. I hate to say that as a representative of my gender, but it doesn't look good for the males in this story. So that's our current state. Then we get to what happens to Sisera. So we said Sisera flees, and he goes to the tent of Yael, Eshet Chever HaKeni, the wife of Chever. So now we know this fellow we read about before who had moved and left the Keni, that's her husband. So he goes to her tent because there's peace. Ki shalom bein Yavin melech Chatzor ubein beis Chever HaKeni. Because there's peace between Yavin, king of Canaan, and Chever, the Cani, and that goes back to Abarbanel's point that he has broken with the rest of the Cani, and he has created an alliance with Canaan.
How does he manage her tent? Like, does she lure him in there, or did he just take it? Was it just by chance that he?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. Take a look at the next sentence, and then answer the question.
Before we get there, can I ask also? No, I forgot my question. What did we just say? Yeah. There's peace between, so all three, the Cani now have peace with them and with them.
No.
We're saying
he broke away.
I know, but my point is that he was comfortable going in because they're friends of Yavin Melech Hatzor. They're friends of the Canaanim.
Yeah.
But then we also said that only
he is.
But he didn't know.
Only he is. Only Beis Chever HaKeni. In other words, not all the Cani. Chever is friends with.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
In other words, Chever went to an area where he was going to live with the enemy.
Yeah. Well, the question is, was this something he had done years ago, or was it something he did now, and he created an alliance with them as a way of setting himself up? But yes.
But the fight is happening in the enemy camps versus. Didn't they draw Sisera to them?
No, they came down from the mountain.
They came down from the mountain.
Yeah. Benita, what are you going
to
say?
I was going to ask. He went into Yael's tent. He didn't go into her husband's tent. I'm thinking that there's two tents.
Yes.
And he went into the woman's tent.
Yep.
Because he didn't think that anything was going to happen to him in the woman's tent.
Good. And that's indeed a major explanation. We're going to come back to that in a moment, because I think that's a key point to pick up on. But right now, he runs towards her tent, right? Because there's peace with her family. But I don't think he knows it's her tent initially, because look at the next sentence. Vateitze Yael likras Sisra. Yael goes out to greet Sisra. Vatomer 11, she said to him, Sura Adoni. Sura is a verb suggesting that you're leaving the path you were on. He was not on a trajectory that would take him to her tent. He was on the path to get to this area. He thinks this is a safe area. And she says to him, think Avraham, you know, with the three travelers, right? She comes out of the tent and says, come on over here. That's the idea.
So then he just took a break in front of the tent, like he was running, and then he stopped
looking for a place to hide.
But did he even know that this was like friendly?
Yes.
Did he know it was?
That's what we're told in the previous sentence. He definitely knows that there's peace.
But this area is where they're living.
So yes. He is trying to find an ally, and she comes out of the tent. We don't know where her husband is. We do. It appears that they actually have different tents. This is her tent. And that's going to become important in another couple of lines. But she says to him, leave the path you're on, come to me, don't be afraid. And those are the magic words, right? She says to him, don't be afraid. That's the mantra of the woman speaking to the man in this story. Vayasar eleha ha'ohala, and he goes to her tent. Vatechaseu basimicha, and she covers him up in a blanket. So Sisra, I don't think, goes initially thinking he's going to Yael, based on what we just read. He thinks he's going to allies in general. Yael says, come into my tent. And he goes, and yes, I think because he thinks, well, what's going to hurt me there? You know, I'll be safe. Vayomer eleha, and he says to her, Hashkini na ma'at mayim ki tzamesi. He says, give me a little bit of water. I'm thirsty. Vatiftach es nod hechalav. She opens up the jug of milk, vatashkeyu vatachaseyu, and she gave him milk to drink, and then she covered him up. Now, well, he had to be uncovered to go drink. You don't, otherwise he gets on the blanket, it's a mess. But she's taking great pains to cover him up. In other words, she's acting as though she is on his side. Let me make sure that no one's going to spot you. Right, she's being very conscientious about how she does it. So that's all right. It's a women's share. That's what's going on here in this passage is that she is now showing herself to be taking care of him, but she gave him milk
instead of water.
He asked for water. Right? So this is going to be emphasized now on the page. I can't even turn the page. Sorry. All right. Thanks. Chapter 5. If you go ahead to chapter 5, please. Page 24. Page 24. Pasuk 24. Hey, Chav Dalet. This is where Devorah, in her song, says, Tivorach minashim Yael eshes chevarak heini. Yael should be blessed among women. Minashim ba'ohel tevorach, she should be blessed from all the women of the tent. And we'll talk about the phrase women of the tent, that comes up later. Mayim sha'al, he asked for water. Chalav nasana, and she gave him milk. So evidently, this was a big deal. And it was something that helped Yael accomplish what she was going to accomplish. In other words, I might have read just chapter 4 and thought she's being generous. Like, maybe milk is a more scarce commodity. Maybe milk is
more
expensive.
She didn't offer him
water. No, she offered him shelter. She didn't say, let's bring you some bread and butter and,
Yeah, so he's in the middle of running for his life. I don't think he was ready for
such a wanted feast. To hide, not sit and eat.
No, but even water? Like, isn't that usually, someone walks in the first thing?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. She didn't offer him...
Come, don't be afraid.
But then, but on the other hand, it is
quick,
battle.
Come in, I'll hide you. Yeah.
Oh, but she's busy covering him with a blanket.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe he's saying it as she's covering him.
Yeah, but it is true. No, it is definitely true that the other possibility is that she didn't have the opportunity. In other words, he's racing along. Presumably he's not walking, right? He's racing along. She spots him from the tent. She comes out and says, come on in. how much time does she have to even make that decision that this is what she's going to do, let alone to get some water?
Then you kind of have to assess the situation. Are they following? Are they coming?
Right.
Right, but he thought it, like...
He thought of it only after he's in the tent and covered. He says, by the way, I could use some water.
Right, then
he's first priority is to get out,
not
of
like
the,
a visitor
out of the way so that no one will see him.
I don't know.
Look, if you want to say that you're breaking the stereotype of the good hostess, that's fine.
No, most of these stories start with they come into the tent and then...
They take off their shoes.
Yeah, but they're not being chased by an army.
And then they have a
dream. Right. Really he was with the Canadian Army.
No, but I think I'm very planned. And so he, if we're saying that he went there in advance to kind of, I'm going to be their friend and I'm going to leave my, you know, fellow whatever to come, you would think he and his wife would either devise a plan or something like, how are we going to help? And if they were going to help, it might have been known amongst the general public that they were there to help. But it kind of seems very happenstance. They didn't know that Cicero was going to run away or, you know, and then the fact that he did, all of a sudden it was like very last minute, hey, come in here.
Right. And that supports the view that this was, that supports the view that this was happenstance. In other words, you have two legitimate explanations for why they moved.
Do we really have to hold that this was her tent and not his tent? Meaning,
well,
like, why can't it just be she's the one in front of you? It's the same thing like when you go to someone's house, so... Whoever opened the door, it becomes their tent. Does that mean they don't
even know? So we do have other stories in Tanakh with separate tents, such as Yaakov and his wives. They, you know, they have the different tents. On the other hand...
And also, we don't know how set up they were. I mean, if it was yesterday or if it's been there
right.
for years.
This is true. But I think the fact that... I think the fact that it says, Oh, hell, Yael, is what catches my eye. It says, Oh, hell, Yael. He went to the tent of Yael. That makes it sound like there's a tent of Chever and there's a tent of Yael. But I have no proof for it beyond that. The...
So what I see here, because I'm still reading, is that she actually planned this because she gave him milk to sort of make him more sleepy because milk relaxes.
So that's where,
yeah,
that's one of the possibilities.
It was only once he was there that she had got the
idea. That's once he asked for something.
Correct. So that's where I'm going with this, is to explain how we get to that conclusion. In other words, it isn't just, well, milk makes you sleepy, but the fact that the book takes pains to say that this was what she did, that he asked for water and she gave milk, and that Devorah includes it in her praise, tells me there must have been some kind of a plot involved. This wasn't just, I'm giving him something nicer, or for that matter, I have no water on hand, so let me give him milk. This was actually part of a plan. This is what she did. I don't think this is a plan that's, even within Abarbanel's view that Chever moved there to be a resource and so forth, you can't possibly plan, the enemy general is gonna need to flee and he's gonna run past my tent. This isn't this isn't part of the playbook. This is just what ended up happening.
Yeah, she just grabbed the circumstances.
Yeah, she took advantage of the opportunity. So let's see what happens. She gives him the milk. She covers him up again. Vayomer eleha, and he says to her, Amod Pesach HaOhel, stand guard, right? Go to the entrance of the tent, and I want you to stand there. V'hayayim ish yavo, and if anybody shows up, ush eilech, and asks you, V'amar hayesh po ish, is there anybody here, or is there a man here? V'amart ayin, you should say, no, no men in here, no generals, there are no generals here, you will have to look elsewhere for generals. The idea here of is there a man here is either they're going to be asking, is there a stranger here? Or alternatively, Malbim suggests that it's actually not that, but that if she's alone in the tent, then the people searching for him won't go into the tent. It's improper. So it's not asking, is Sisera in there? But if there's no man around, then we're not going to go in, which I find a little difficult when you're in the middle of battle and you're searching for the enemy general. Like, you'll say, well, she's alone in there. I can't, you know. That doesn't read right. There's something wrong there. Nonetheless. Oh, one other note. I included it on the sheet. If you take a look at source number one, I did want to note for you. This business of giving him the water... And giving him the milk, I should say, instead of the water, is often associated with another story which has various associations with ours, and that is from the book of Judith, the book of Yehudit, which, as we were discussing before, is from the Apocrypha. It's not found in Tanakh. And it describes a Greek general by the name of Holofernes. We think he's Greek, actually. I shouldn't assume that, but presumably. A general by the name of Holofernes being killed by a woman, by a Jewish woman by the name of Judith. And the key passage here is that she comes to him and has a feast with him. And when evening came, his slaves quickly withdrew. Bagoas, who's the servant, closed the tent from outside and shut out the attendants from his master's presence. They went to bed, for they all were weary because the banquet had lasted so long. But Judith was left alone in the tent, with Holofernes stretched out on his bed, for he was dead drunk. That's the translation that I have for this. I didn't edit in, like, dead drunk as opposed to just, you know, generally intoxicated. So that gets quoted in Jewish sources as the source for eating dairy foods on Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. How do you get dairy foods out of that source?
Doesn't say.
She pretend, when they left, Judith pretended that this his head that she cut off was his cheese at some point.
Mm. No? She does take his head. She takes his head and puts it in the bag, and then takes the bag back.
Or told people it was cheese.
So
comparing the stories.
That's what's happening. It's a linking of the two stories because they are so similar. Jewish woman killing enemy general
in a tent
and involving him being asleep, right? The difference being, of course, in one case his head gets cut off, in the other case not. But the don't sweat the details. But the point is that we're borrowing from what Yael did with the milk because we don't know how he got drunk, but odds are it's wine.
I didn't realize it didn't mention milk. I thought I always thought it did.
Yeah.
But if we're thinking that it's wine, then what does that have to do with it?
Correct. Correct. And the answer is that the stories get merged.
We should really eat dairy.
I've never even heard that you have to eat dairy.
No, I know. I also provide foods as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the oil is the oil is definitely better known.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should have wine according to this.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we don't know. It didn't say it was wine. Didn't say she that it was wine, but you can assume.
Well, he was drunk.
Yes. Dead drunk, and he had a feast. So odds are it was wine, yes. Okay. So so in Pasuk, we're now up to Pasuk Chaf Aleph, sentence 21. And I think that's where we're now officially on new territory. This is everything we did until now was just review of what we had done in this section. Now we see something new. Vatikach Yael Eshes Chever es Yisad HaOhel. Yael, wife of Chever, took the tent peg. Now, tent peg, don't think small little plastic thing, like tent peg, as in this is your home and it's your anchor for your home. So, Vatasem es Hamakeves Biyada. And then she took the hammer in hand. Vatavoy love balot, and she came to him in secret. Vatiska es hayaseid berakaso, and she bashed the peg into his skull. Vatitznach ba'aretz. What is vatitznach?
It's like parachute.
Right, sanchanim are paratroopers. It means to strike down with great force. That's what it is.
Pierce. Isn't that the word was used for at the beginning when she bawled her donkey?
Vatitznach me'al hachamor. Yep.
Same word.
Same word. So vatitznach ba'aretz. So the she drives the peg into the ground through his head. Vahunir dam, he had been sleeping. Vayaaf vayamos, he had been exhausted or he fainted, either way, and then he died.
It's funny how they say at the end of the sentence that he was sleeping.
Yeah, it is odd.
Like,
the translation of Ayah.
Like, he's sleeping so she can go do that. It's like, wouldn't he see her? But then it says it.
Right. I think the idea is that he didn't wake up while she was getting set to do this.
Right. Well, he wouldn't see her if he was covered under the blanket. He wouldn't know.
Right. You think she went through the blanket also? You think she didn't pull back the blanket to do this? Ah, if I were doing this, I'd pull back a little of the blanket, maybe.
I mean, I can't imagine how...
No,
don't worry.
Sorry?
I don't even know her, so...
I mean, you want to use that blanket again.
He wasn't interested at all in his troops. He's, like, tired and he falls asleep.
Yes. He's not exactly... Yes.
You know, stand there, worry about your troops. Maybe listen to... If your troop, any of them are coming, or anything that's going on.
Right. I mean, to be fair, I've never been a general, so I don't know. I don't know what had happened.
A leader.
Right. No, but
she tried privately.
And she did. Right. I mean.
Yeah. I know, but that's the point.
He asked for water. Keep in mind, he asked for water. He didn't ask for something that would be heavy. So it could be that he didn't. I feel no need to justify Cicero.
He'd been in battle, and he ran all that way from wherever it was to the tent. So he was exhausted.
We don't know how far
it
is.
But yeah, dropped off.
And the milk helped him.
The fact that the tent peg was lying around, if she would have taken a tent peg from the tent would have collapsed. So
yes.
It proves to me that maybe it was just they just had moved there, and maybe she, you know, some of the supplies about putting up the tent were lying around.
They might have spare.
Yes, I imagine you do have spare time.
Yeah.
I think so. I think it's the sort of thing that you want to have around in the junk drawer in the kitchen or something.
I don't know. She took the hammer.
Yeah, where'd she
get
the hammer from?
The toolbox.
Maybe they always are coming up and out.
See, what you're pointing out with the tent peg is a very important point. This business of the tent peg, because the question is, why didn't she use a real weapon? Like a tent peg and a hammer? So this is one possibility, is that that in fact she uses it because as a woman she doesn't have real weapons around. This isn't like you go to her husband's tent, there you'll find the weapons. Exactly.
I mean, what did they have then? They didn't have guns. They would have had a knife or... Or a bow and arrow or something, I don't know.
Right. I mean, if I have a choice between a knife and a hammer and a sharp peg, I'm going with a hammer and the sharp peg. Yeah. But I think that's one approach. A second element of stressing the tent peg is that it shows heroism. Right? She, you know, this is what she has at her disposal, right? She doesn't have a proper weapon. And yet this is, you know, she does it anyway. But I think there's a third element, which, if you know, for those who are new to Shoftim, this is brand new, but it's something we've seen before. Not in general, but in many cases in Shoftim, we find the Jews using rudimentary weapons. If you remember Shamgar with the cattle goad, right, that he used to strike the enemy. And then we're going to find Shimshon with the jawbone, right, of the donkey, using that to strike them. And here we have Yael with the tent peg. The image is of a population that just has these rudimentary weapons, but God is on their side, and therefore they succeed against Sisera and Canaan and their 900 iron chariots. Mm-hmm. Right? It's meant to show the theme of, you know, like Rabim Biad Ma'atim, the many in the hands of the small. Look, all she had was a tent peg, and she succeeded in, well, and a hammer. And she ended up killing Sisera. But there's... It is messy, but again, that's part of, you know, like Rhoda said, that's not part of peeling back the blanket first, so that, you know, you have to sleep under that blanket tonight.
But you're dying, like, unconscious.
So good. Okay. There's actually more to say about his physical state at this point. I didn't want to go into it now because it's going to be a major part of Chapter 5, but there is more about how he ends up being unconscious than what we've seen in Chapter 4. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to it in 5. Shana.
I'm very curious why it was necessary again to say that it was Eshet Chever. We know which Yael it is. Doesn't she get her own merit at this point? It's very much my kind of question. I don't understand why it was necessary. Like, she's a hero. And we're talking about her. She's somebody's
because
wife.
Because of the fact that there was peace between them.
Yeah, I think it's there. No, I think it's there in order to stress the alliance. In order to say, this is... Right, but it's trying to stress...
He took the initiative to move.
But even without that, I think it's trying to stress the why he trusts her. Why does he leave himself, you know, vulnerable like that? Doesn't he... You know, you're the general. You are, you know, top prize in this. Mm-hmm. Why isn't he scared to just leave himself vulnerable like that? Mm-hmm. To which the answer is, because he knows. She's the wife of Chever, and Chever has made an alliance. I'm going to come back to that. And the fact that it's Chever who made the alliance and not Yael.
And what about the fact that...
Yeah, but it's this is where he's vulnerable. In other words, she is able to do this because she is the wife of Chever. That's the way I would read it.
What about the fact that she is married and it's inappropriate having another man in your tent?
Oh, it gets worse than that. Wait for chapter 5.
I have another question about that.
Yeah, it gets worse than that.
Why did she actually even have to kill him? I mean, like, as a woman, like, she could have stood guard out there. People are walking by. She could have whispered, I have him here. He's sleeping. Come. Like, it's really unusual for a woman to do such a thing, like a gory act like that. I mean, obviously she was a hero, but I'm just surprised.
I mean, I wouldn't stereotype women. You know,
okay,
there could be
it would have been easy for her to get any man. Like, he's sleeping in there.
Right.
The fact that she killed him, was that, I don't know.
I think it's
unusual.
Yeah, I think it is part of her character. I think we're meant to understand that this is who she is. She's not going to go get somebody else to do it. She's not going to wait for Hever to come home, you know, or go over and check in and whatever.
Well, she could have said,
she doesn't want, maybe he wasn't.
Yeah.
Right. Now,
they didn't know where he fled to necessarily.
There is a problem here. And the problem that she has is that she doesn't actually know what's been going on the battlefield. I mean, clearly Sisera is fleeing, so things aren't going well for Canaan. But the commentators ask, why isn't she worried about repercussions? Her family has a treaty of some kind with Canaan. You know, Sisera is not the king. Yavin is the king. Even if Sisera and his army are gone, who says that Canaan isn't still the force to be reckoned with that they've been the past 20 years? You know, does she think that she's going to get away with, you know, breaking an alliance like this? So the commentaries all deal with it, and they give interesting answers. Take a look at what I brought you on the sheet. One approach is to say, and this is one of Malbim's approaches, I brought it in source number 2, that the yes, there was danger in doing it, but how could she not? He says, and I mentioned this before, he believes the family of Chever were Jews. So therefore, ve'echlo yarivu riv amam ve'elokeim, how could they not battle for their nation and their God? In other words, yes, it's true, but there was a stronger alliance at play. And that's one approach. So yes, she endangered herself, but that's the way it goes. A second approach is that this was under the terms of the deal. And what I mean by that is, take a look at source number 3. This is a different approach. After what I told Ora before, right, that it was just his family and not all of the Cani who made the alliance with Canaan, I will now show you that Malbim suggests maybe that wasn't true. Hashalom shebein Yavin ubeis chever hayashalom kolel im b'nei Cani ashochnim b'midbar Yehuda. In fact, he says, the peace was with all of the Cani. The Cani now had an alliance with Canaan. Shalzeh amr uvein beis chever ha-Cani. When the Pasuk said, with the house of chever, it meant with the Cani as a whole, not just Chever personally. Ve'ata shenifrad Chever me'eis echa v'nata ahalo bein b'nei Yisrael, but Chever had now moved to be among the Jews in Kedesh. Ein alav chiyuv habris shel b'nei Cani. He's no longer bound by it. So it's an entirely different view of what was going on politically in this story. Instead of the way we viewed it, which was Cani loved Jews, he broke away in order to make an alliance with Canaan, rather, there wasn't any alliance for Chever. The Cani were the ones who had been allied with Canaan, and Chever left that, and therefore he had no allegiance to Yavin and to Sisera and so forth. So that's a second explanation. What I found,
He went there because of the relationship.
No, but this is taking a different view. In other words, Malbim is not going along with the narrative we've presented. He's taking a different view of what was going on.
And what does he do with the pasuk that says that's why he went there?
The pasuk only said that he actually went there. It didn't say.
Well, it said because of the relationship.
It said.
He
separated from Cain. No, but you mean why? You don't mean why Chever moved? Why he went to the tent?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So I guess because he was assuming that because the Cani in general are friendly, he can still he has something to trade on with Chever. Maybe he didn't recognize it, but you're right. Mm-hmm. I think that's a weakness in what Malbim is suggesting. I think it makes it harder to read that sentence.
Unless he just thinks that the guy didn't break away. He moved, but he's still part of them. So he's still
Right. And Abar Benel has a different twist on it. He looks at that phrase and says, the Pasuk says there was peace between Yavin and Chever HaKeni, not Sisera. There's an alliance with the king, but not necessarily with the general. I find that...
the general...
Yeah, I find that politically difficult.
If you have a alliance with the king, then you're going to support his general.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's like...
Right. Now, I find it to be difficult, I have to admit. I'm bringing it for sake of completeness, but yes, it's a difficult argument to sustain. I think it's easier to sustain that he simply had a greater that she had a greater loyalty to the Jews. Or, alternatively, there's this other approach that Abar Benel brings in source number 4. He says, it's because she's a woman that she can get away with this. take a look at what he writes. I find this fascinating. I have no idea if this is historically accurate in terms of what would have gone on in those days, but look what he writes. Shenischabru shtei hasibos. He says, there were two reasons, l'shem matza Ya'el makom laso zeh poal, which enabled Ya'el to do what she did. Harishona first, he ki b'inyanei ha-malachim, ein ha-devar asur o mutar na'e o migune. He says, when it comes to royal affairs, the things that kings do, something is allowed or not allowed, not based on whether it's considered to be something that is praiseworthy or something that is disgraceful. It's only based on their agreements, meaning there's a treaty between two sides. You follow the treaty. That's all there is. But it's not about this is a good thing to do or a bad thing to do. There, you know, it's politics. It's a very Machiavellian way of looking at it. So when Chever makes his treaty, his chakem ma'od, he was very sharp. It said there was peace between Yavin of Chatzor and the family of Chever. It didn't say the house of Yavin, meaning, as I said, it doesn't include Sisera. But the second reason, he says, is ki Sisera lo halach lo ohel Chever Akeni kim lo ohel ishto. He went to the wrong tent. He didn't go to Chever's tent. He went to Yael's tent. And this is supporting the idea of separate tents. V'yadua mini musei ha-malachim she'ein ha-isha mechuyeves l'dvarim she'yaseh ha-bal.
Come on.
She's not subject to the treaty. It was his treaty. It's not my treaty. I find it fascinating. I mean, Abarbanel is big in government at the end of the 15th century. So it may not tell me what went on in Canaan, but it tells me what went on in the end of the 15th century in Christian Europe.
But in general, the wife was obligated to the husband.
Today, yes, but maybe not always. It's a very interesting explanation.
I think how much more so? They were more progressive then?
I would go, they're more obligated to do whatever their husband does.
I would think they're
excluded in a way.
I think more so they'd have to follow whatever their
husband. Unless you say, I'm going to be even worse
woman
now.
Understand all the politics.
The following words that I'm going to say are not my personal point of view.
Disclaimer.
But if in that period of time, in that region, women were viewed as chattel, right? If they are property of the husband and so on, then they're not bound by treaties. They're not part of that. They're not considered responsible citizens. It could be that that's what he is suggesting was going on. I'm not a player. Did I break your treaty? I'm sorry. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, my silly little wife. She didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah. No, it could be that that's, yeah. Boy, I'm debating whether I should erase the recording.
But that, oh, we're recording? As long as they don't take it out of context.
Yeah, the
right?
Machine's out of battery. What?
As long as they don't take it out of context.
Yeah, because that never happens. The so that's she executes Sisera. She has chosen to side with the Jews effectively by doing this. For whatever reason, however she justifies going against this agreement, whether it was her husband's agreement, maybe her husband wasn't part of the agreement, and so forth. But look what she does next. After she has now killed him, Pasuk Chav Bet, sentence 22. Along comes Barak, right? A day late, a dollar short, whatever phrase you want to use. V'hinei Barak, Rodefa Sisera. Barak comes pursuing Sisera. Vateitze Ya'el ekrasau. Ya'el leaves the tent to greet him. Vatomer lo. And she says to him, Lech ve'areka es ha'isha sharata mevakesh. Go, I'm going to show you the man you are seeking. Vayavoela, he goes to her. V'hine Sisera nofel mace. Sisera is fallen dead. Vayase barakasa, with the peg still sticking out of his skull. For drama, you know. Yeah. So take a look on your sheet at source number 5. I don't know how long it took Barak to follow his trail.
He's still there.
Right, Barak had gone in the other direction.
That's what I'm saying. Right. It's not right away.
It could be. Well, take a look at source number 5. Take a look at source number 5. This is, again, Book of Judith. After she has killed Holofernes. Soon afterwards, she went out and gave Holofernes' head to her maid, who placed it in her food bag. There's your... Then the two of them went out together, as they were accustomed to do for prayer. you know, so that nobody will figure out what's going on. From a distance, Judith called out to the sentries at the gate, "Open, open the gate. God, our God, is with us, still showing his power in Israel and his strength against our enemies as he has done today." And she said to them with a loud voice, "Praise God, O praise him. Praise God who has not withdrawn his mercy from the house of Israel, but has destroyed our enemies by my hand this very night." Then she pulled the head out of the bag and showed it to them and said, "See here the head of Holofernes, the commander of the Syrian army. Here is the canopy beneath which he lay in his drunken stupor. The Lord has struck him down by the hand of a woman. As the Lord lives, who has protected me in the way I went, I swear that it was my face that seduced him to his destruction, and he committed no sin with me to defile and shame me," which is part of the discussion that's going to be relevant in chapter 5. Mm-hmm. We have to come back to that and the relevance of that particular statement. But what I'm showing you is another parallel in the story, is the displaying of the executed general. So there's a lot more that we have to see, you know, obviously on this. We'll just read quickly sentences 23 and 24. Vayachna Elokim bayamahu es Yavin melech Kanaan lifnei bnei Yisrael. God humbled King Yavin before Israel on that day. Right, all his troops have now been routed. Vatelech Yav bnei Yisrael haloch vekashal Yavin melech Kanaan, and the Jews became the dominant force over Yavin. Remember, the Jews have, and we've seen this repeatedly in this short section of the book we've already read, the Jews have become like the Kanaanim around them. So either the Kanaanim are going to be ruling them cruelly, or the Jews are going to be ruling the Kanaanim cruelly. The Ad Asher Hichrisu Es Yavin Melech Kanaan, until they finally eliminated Yavin, king of Kanaan, meaning the whole line of these kings Yavin that they had been dealing with. So what we're going to have to do next time is, I want to, before we go on to chapter 5, I want to discuss a little bit about the issue of women and war and how the story of Yael is used in that context in Jewish law. And then I want to continue with the Song of Devorah and what it adds to our understanding of what happened between Devorah and Barak, and what happened and why you only had certain tribes showing up for the battle. We only had two tribes that were actually involved, it sounds like here, and what happened between Yael and Sisera. So, God willing, next week. Again, if